Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome back to Close Reads here on the Close Reads Podcast Network. I'm David Kern and I am joined by Heidi White and our very special guest, Karen Swallow-Pryor. Karen, Heidi, welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
So we are here to wrap up our Sense and Sensibility discussion to answer your questions, listener questions. We posted the thread on the Facebook group. So if you haven't done that yet, you missed the boat, I suppose. But you can always join the group to join the conversation that's ongoing there on the thread. And of course, you can also follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at Close Reads Pods. Should you need to get in touch with us, you can also do that at closereadspodcasts@gmail.com. We got lots of questions. There's lots of conversation, some of it making fun of our good friend Brandon, some of it arguing with him, but we'll leave that for the threads. So if you want to engage in that debate, that sometimes not so gentle debate, you can do so over there. I want to say a quick couple notes. We'll give a little bit of news quickly for those of you who don't follow us on social media or get our email. We are going to begin the Odyssey. We're actually going to begin it next week. So next week, we are going to start with books 1 and 2. And then the week after that, we'll do 2, 3, and 4. And then after that, it'll vary a little bit based on what's going on in that section of that epic poem. So I'm going to send an email out later this week that shares all that. So if you want to make sure you are privy to that information, you can head over to the Facebook group or closereadspodcasts.com and sign up for the email there. And we'll send all that out. If you're not on social media, that's the best place to get that. And then on August 7th, we're going to bring back the plays, The Thing. And that's when Tim is done with his long countrywide road trip. And Tim's going to lead the conversation there through Othello. And then after that, we're going to do The Tempest. And I'll be posting, you know, further out reading schedules on the different books after the Odyssey. We are going to do The Rector of Justin by Auchincloss, and then we're going to do A River Runs Through It, I think. So we've got lots of great stuff coming down the pipe, as they say, down the pipeline, around the corner. You know, choose your metaphor. In the meantime, this week, let's talk about Sense and Sensibility one final time. Before we do that, I want to just thank you, Karen, for being on the show. This has been a lot of fun to have you joining us. It was fortuitous or providential, I suppose, that you were working on a Sense and Sensibility project, but it's been so much fun to talk to you. I know Heidi and I both love your book, and so it's been, I guess, special even to just be able to talk about this book with you. So thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you. It's been an honor and it's been fun too, most importantly.
Well, I'm glad. I'm glad to hear that it's been fun for you too and not too stressful. Hopefully these questions today won't leave a sour taste in your mouth. I think there's plenty of great questions here, but sometimes they can be cleverly worded. So let's start here. Sarah asked a question that we did talk about. I brought this up last week. So maybe she didn't listen to the episode at that point, but I want to bring it up within the context of her question. And she asks this: why is Edward such a prize? Obviously he's a man of his word, which is to be admired, but he's also portrayed as shy, awkward, moody, and directionless. So what was it that drew Eleanor to him on such short acquaintance and made her so secure in her love through uncertainty? And then she says, why the blazes did he visit the Dashwoods cottage in the early middle part of the book? Surely his obligation as their brother's brother-in-law could have been politely excused. It seems he wanted to see and spend more time with Eleanor even while he was still engaged to Lucy. So this makes me like him less for keeping Eleanor dangling, so to speak. So this is Sarah. And people did respond to this, including Brandon, who says that Colonel Brandon's the actual prize. So I think, you know, based on the portrayal, Karen, you did mention last week that in some ways her attraction to him has been solidified before the book ever began. So is that enough to answer her question, do you think?
Well, no, I think she asked something else too, which is worth looking at. She asks, she says, you know, he's portrayed as, however she said it, not
shy, awkward, moody, and directionless. Yeah.
And that's true, but I think that portrayal primarily comes from Marianne. That's how Marianne sees him. I may not be remembering some other narrative perspective, but it's Marianne who kind of sees him as not as charming as some other men, I guess. So that might be a further complication to how he's portrayed. I don't know. What do you think, Heidi?
Yeah, I think that that you're right. That is how Marianne sees him, and that's kind of how Marianne needles at Eleanor about it when they're kind of doing their passive aggressive sister thing. But there's but Marianne has a great affection for Edward and wants her sister, she wants Eleanor to marry him. Mm-hmm. So I think that the directionlessness of Edward is a bit of Austin pointing at some of the flaws within the society. I think that there's some social commentary on that portrayal too. Like, this is a society that can come up with nothing for such a good man to do with his life. Right. Mm-hmm. And he's also then dependent on his mother and her good opinion of him, which of course is lost and then somewhat regained. And so there's all this complicatedness. The three of us have talked a lot about the economic pressure that these people are under. And Edward is a victim of that, just as the women are.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think it's very hard for a man who is a good catch in this society to meet our standards of what constitutes a good catch post American dream and democracy rise of the middle class. So, I think we do have a hard time warming to someone like Edward, because their society was so different. And, you know, it's not like he's hardworking and, you know, the kinds of things that we would, would appeal to us today.
Right.
So, I joked that Brandon, for obvious reasons, given his name, says that Colonel Brandon is actually the prize. I'm curious about what you think of that sort of, I guess, dichotomy that he's proposing there, that Brandon's the actual prize, but Eleanor loves Edward for the reasons that she loves Edward. You know, even if maybe he's not the prize, it wouldn't be surprising that Eleanor, of all characters, would be drawn towards someone who is perhaps not traditionally thought of as the prize. But then in the end, Marianne gets the prize. So is the dichotomy that Brandon's suggesting there fair? I mean, do you think that in the end, Colonel Brandon is the one who's the real prize? Or is that just Brandon, you know, are we just learning a lot more about Brandon than we are about Colonel Brandon?
Brandon LeBlanc is the hidden, or sometimes not so hidden kind of.
There's nothing hidden about Brandon, right?
There's nothing hidden about Brandon. He is he's a man who forms very strong opinions about things and gets conversations going.
And then we make fun of him on the air when he can't defend himself.
It's so great. Yes. well, that he doesn't need defending from us. He is a.
Of course not.
No. Yes. I think he's making a really good point that Colonel, and I think that's one of the big questions of the novel that comes up at the end over and over again. Why does Marianne get this guy who has all this money and he's, you know, blah, blah, blah. And why doesn't the protagonist get the better man? Does that mean I'm missing something and that Edward is supposed to be the better man? Or is it just an opinion that anybody is free to have and Brandon's taking a stand, right?
So, as he does.
Yes.
This is a good question because I think, you know, again, in Austin, everything's nuanced and complicated. So I think both Edward and Colonel Brandon are prizes in different ways. Mm. Colonel Brandon is definitely the more active character, person. He's more, you know, he does things and he intervenes and he helps and he's not passive the way so many of the men in this aristocracy are. But I think what it is, and I'll even go back to Pride and Prejudice again, I think that Colonel Brandon is the best catch for Marianne because he is what she needs. And I think that Eleanor and Edward are much better matched as well. Because they sort of each part of the couple tempers one another appropriately. It's like Jane and Bingley are, they love one another, but they're sort of, you know, they're both sort of not that passionate kind of people, and they're warm rather than hot. And so they're well matched. Whereas Elizabeth and Darcy, you know, they love each other, but they're also sort of equally passionate. So I think, you know, I think in Austen, so much is about the match, not just the person.
Right.
That's it. Well, hence the titles, right? Or at least the,
right. Yeah.
I mean, as we've talked about, you could have any variety of words paired together about any number of characters in these books, I suppose. Okay, Gabrielle asks, why does Austen save the big wrap-up and resolution for the very last chapter and pages of the story? It seems abrupt and hasty, almost hasty, how she wraps up the Marianne Brandon storyline. We did touch on this a little bit last time. But she asks, is this stylistic of the time, or is this an Austen thing, perhaps even evidence of her inexperience? Karen, would you say that kind of a wrap-up to the storyline, as Gabrielle put it, is that a common thing of the period in literature?
I would say it's a common thing of these earlier novels to not culminate with the marriage the way that we expect. And what I mean by that is we have an Austen sort of abrupt endings, but we also have an earlier novelist, the marriage occurring way before the end because there are other things that happen as a result of it. So just, you know, the ending being in the marriage and that sort of being the culmination is more of a modern thing, I think.
Is that, is that because formally things have evolved, or there's more like the way we think about pathos and catharsis and all that has evolved more? I mean, I don't know if those questions are even separate, actually, now that I say them.
Yeah, well, I think that is part of it, but I think also, again, these novels by Austen and other ones that I'm thinking of are not, they're not just about marriage. They're about society and all and everything being right in the family and in society and not just for the couple. And so now we focus much more on the individual protagonist and their development and resolution and so forth. So, but that's part of how the novel developed along with this rise of the individual. And so it's, you know, the form and content of the novel sort of evolve along with our concept of the individual and the prominence and importance of the individual.
Heidi, do you want to add to that, or do you want to go to the next question?
Well, I mean, I do just want to briefly say also, we need to keep in mind, she is not, again, just telling a love story. There's a whole lot of other threads that are going into this that are being developed and resolved. And so we, you know, as readers, we want to get to the end when they get married and we figure out who ends up with who, but that's not always the whole point. So as she kind of goes quickly there, that feels like the culmination, but there's all these other threads that she's tracing as well.
Right.
Okay. Due to the nature of this particular episode, we're going to move on to the next question now. Okay. So Anne asks, she says, I'm interested in how that society, meaning the society of Austen's time and in the book, viewed Willoughby's past impregnation and abandonment of Eliza. I know that her life was effectively ruined, and in my eyes, his actions with Eliza disqualified him from suitable marriage with Marianne before they even met. Is that how Austen and her society would have viewed it? A couple people echoed this question and the desire for us to bring it up. So, Gabrielle commented in particular that it surprised me that Eleanor gave him any sympathy, albeit reserved, knowing this part of his past. And I assume she means when he came and explained himself. She was surprised that given his past, Eleanor sympathized with him at all. So Karen, I'll go to you first again, because that seems to be the pattern that I've fallen into. Would they have viewed his relationship with Eliza as disqualifying him from suitable marriage with Marianne before they even met, despite Marianne's opinion that, you know, there's an only one person type? person for each person. I have no idea what I just said, but you know what I mean.
No, this is actually the, my not coincidentally, I decided to cover this book in my summer book club sponsored by my church. So we actually, and we just finished volume two last week. And this question came up about Willoughby and how he would be viewed in this society. And it was a really good discussion. And now I can't remember it all. But I think there are, I guess some members of the book club were actually just even sort of surprised that this sort of stuff was going on. And well, yes, it was. So we have a couple of indications going on in the book. One is that Willoughby is at risk of, or he does get disinherited because of this behavior, right? Mm, yeah. But it's because the woman, and I can't even remember her name, but you know, his benefactress, here's someone, I mean, she holds this power in her hands over him, and she must be of a certain kind of character to wield it that way. But someone else might not. So, and then we have Colonel Brandon, who got into a dueled with Willoughby? Mm-hmm. And he thought that would take care of it. So Colonel Brandon, you know, has his own sort of form of punishment or justice. So we have characters who show how serious a thing this is. But it's also, I mean, clear in this culture that this double standard is alive and well. I mean, all of the concern over Marianne is that something like this could have happened to her too. Mm. It seems like there is sort of acceptance of the reality that this double standard, this double sexual standard exists, and it happens, and it's normal, even if we frown upon it. But at the same time, we don't want to be the ones, or our loved ones to be the ones who fall victim to it. It sounds an awful lot like today. In that respect, I guess. I don't know.
Okay, so Heidi,
this is a great question.
It is.
Heidi, so then let's talk about the second part of the question that Gabrielle followed up with, because she asked about Eleanor's response. Like, why was, given that, why then was Eleanor as, you know, sympathetic as she was, knowing this part of his past and knowing his, you know, about what could have happened to her sister?
I'm glad you asked me that, because this is a part of the question I'm really interested in. I think from my reading of that section, the sympathy that Eleanor has is not necessarily to let him off the hook for a moral failure. Oh, now I get it, blah, blah. But her sympathy is oriented towards it now. At least I know he loved my sister. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's personal. It's about the relationship with Marianne. Mm. And it is very clear from the way that Eleanor thinks and talks to Willoughby that she considers him morally disqualified from pursuing Marianne, not just because he's married, but because of what he did. The sympathy is not oriented at all towards what he did, but she's thankful that she knows that he loved her sister.
Hmm. And I completely agree with what Heidi is saying here. It wasn't, and you put it so well. It's almost like she was, it's like, oh, we weren't crazy. We were, right. You know, right. We're justified in that sense. But another just sort of historical background is that in the 18th century, even before, but, you know, really peaking in the 18th century, there was actually a saying, and some of the other earlier novels dealt with this. There's a saying that a reformed rake makes the best husband.
Huh. I've never known that before.
Yeah.
I learned something. That's interesting.
So there was just
this, can you say what that is again?
Yes. A reformed rake makes the best husband. Hmm. Now, there are a few layers of it. You know, one sense of that is simply that, a man who's gone out and sown his wild oats and gotten it over with, you know, he's going to settle down and be the best husband. Then there's another meaning that's a little bit, you know, bawdier. But yep. it was a saying, an ideal. And so a lot of novels dealt with it. So the novels, so Pamela by Samuel Richardson, who was a huge influence on Austen, one of her favorite novelists, is the story of this rake who tries to seduce/rape Pamela and doesn't succeed and ends up winning her heart and marries her. And she lives happily ever after. And when I teach this to my students today, they just cannot believe, like, she would marry a guy who tried to rape her. Like, and that's a happily ever after. And there's a lot of unpacking we have to do of that reality of that time. So now we are 50 or 60 years later, and things are changing. There is actually sort of an elevation in morality that's taking place in Austen's lifetime that continues through the Victorian age. So Austen doesn't adhere to that old view that a reformed rake makes the best husband, but she still lives in a society that has that remnants of that idea.
Do you know where that saying derives from, or where it started popping up? What time period?
I don't know if it has one origin, but it's just rooted in so much romanticism and classical literary tropes. I mean, it's one of those things where, we can... Even today we have trouble, like there can be things that are in literature that weren't really in life, but we look back and they're literary tropes. That doesn't mean they really were lived out, but then they do influence thinking, if that makes sense. So it was definitely a literary trope. But it was, we can look, I mean, it obviously carried weight and influence. There was a lot of, body poetry and restoration drama, that whole period was one that was quite licentious.
It sounds to me like it's something that would even go back to like Chaucer.
Yeah.
Sounds like something Chaucer would have made the theme of one of his tales.
Yeah. A lot of, Christians today think, and this is a whole other topic, but I'll just try to put it as briefly as possible. We think that morality has always been on a decline. And it's just not, I mean, there, it cycles in and out. There are peaks and valleys, and then there are some things that are moral that are approved and other things that are immoral that are, it just shifts. But there was a licentiousness that defined the Restoration Age and the 18th century that kind of waned with the rise of the Victorian era and the evangelical influence. And so there are peaks and valleys. And so Austen was writing at a time where morality and authentic Christianity was sort of on the rise.
Okay, again, the nature of this episode is that sometimes we end the topic a little bit abruptly, but this next question comes
just
from...
Just like Austen.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Next chapter. All right, this comes from April, and she has a question about the narrator, the unreliability. And she says that... the books that we've read this year have some measure of unreliability in the narrator. We have Stephen's self-deception in Remains of the Day. We have the mystery and betrayal in The Spy Who Came in from the Cold, the non-memoir of Ralph Moody and Little Britches, and then now the shifting perspectives and opinions in Sense and Sensibility. And she says that this is a literary device that was new to her, and so she would love to hear more discussion about it. And she asks very specifically, what benefits does a book gain from an unreliable narrator? And how could it be used poorly? And then this is probably something to touch on. When approaching an unknown book, what should be our assumptions about a narrator going in? So, Heidi, I'll let you touch on this one first, just to mix things up a little bit. What benefits does a book gain from an unreliable narrator? And we'll start with that part of the question first. I mean, there's three different parts here that we can address, and I don't want to spend the rest of the show on it. We could obviously do like an entire episode just talking about unreliable narrators, or do a webinar or something. But what do you think about this?
That's a fair caution for me, what you just said, because as you know, because we've had this conversation before, I love unreliable narrators. They're one of my favorite literary devices. I think they're a well-written, unreliable narrator is like a literary masterpiece craft kind of thing. So, Wuthering Heights, for example, like that's just the most perfect unreliable narrator. So anyway, I
do think that with the shifting perspectives in Austin, we see multiple people's flawed perspectives. And that could be, you could say that that's an unreliable narrator. That would probably fall into that category. But I think it is more this idea of let's look at this from multiple perspectives in order to kind of get a view of the characters and also of this society. But a benefit that it gains is from an unreliable narrator is that, I mean, it makes the book more interesting, and it makes the reader into a kind of detective when we are trying to figure out what's really going on. And that draws us into the book and makes us gives us as readers and as critics and students, the capacity to make judgments on what's happening in the book, including the narrator as a character. If the narrator is perfect and says everything perfectly, or if we have kind of that outside voice that's just kind of godlike looking over the story, it takes a little bit, I think it takes more work on the reader's part to get invested and involved in the story than an unreliable narrator gives us the opportunity to make judgments. So I think that's a benefit.
Karen, so do you want to add to that, or should I move on to this next part?
I think technically speaking, and there's always different ways of looking at it, but unreliable narrators are generally first person narrators. So they mm-hmm. are like a character, as Heidi mentioned. Mm-hmm. And they are, so someone who's writing irony or satire, I guess, in a looser sense, they're unreliable. But in a different way from what I would strictly call an unreliable narrator, if that makes sense. I mean, irony and satire and comedy are different modes. I'd have to brush up on that a little bit. But
No, you're right. In this book, this isn't an unreliable narrator. Right, you're right. This is right, just multiple right. perspectives kind yes, of
exactly, exactly.
settling by in the eyes of a certain character in a certain situation.
Right. And an irony by definition always has sort of a double perspective. And mm-hmm. so it forces it, which is not the same thing as being yeah. unreliable, but it can right. have, it can still force us to ask the critical questions and to not trust some what's being said on a literal, you know, way. So that's where I think, where this question, maybe the heart of this question is we can't trust the literal words that are being said, that's the perspective, whether it's irony or unreliability. And so we have to do this kind of work as readers.
Technically as a literary term, I mean, it's only it's not even 60 years old, right? Like it wasn't at Wayne Booth in his book, The Rhetoric of Fiction, or whatever his book was called, that first coined the term. And I mean, people were talking about how do you trust what people are saying in books, but it wasn't technically spoken of before that, was it? I mean, like,
maybe not as a term. I don't know. You're probably right about that. I really have no idea. But as a literary device, it has been used for longer.
Oh, right. Well, I mean, yeah, right. Of course. Yeah. But in terms of naming it and I thinking about it in terms of like a technical way, it's kind of
very modernist, as in literary modernism and art idea to have this unreliability. So, and to question and the multiple perspectives and so forth. I mean, I think of I'm actually working on my next introduction, and that's to Heart of Darkness. I mean, mm-hmm. they're one of the first modernist or sort of foreshadowings of modernist literature. And there's an unreliable narrator in Marlowe, even though it's a frame narrative like Wuthering Heights, but,
right.
So, yeah, I think it's a good question, and we get into some really intricate literary questions that we could debate for a long time, and I'd have to brush up on.
I've been sitting here listening to you both talk, I keep trying to figure out what it says about Heidi that when she said the unreliable narrator she most thinks of is the one from Wuthering Heights. That's fascinating to me. Of all the unreliable narrators in all of literature, that's the one that you thought of first.
I love that one. I think it was my first introduction to it when it occurred to me, like what April is saying, what I hear her saying here that I love is it never occurred to me not to trust the narrator before. Mm-hmm. Right? And so once we accept that, once we as readers say, I don't actually have to believe the protagonist, that changes how you read. That's a really important moment in our development as readers.
Okay, well, that brings me then to this last...
Let me just throw one little thing in there. Yeah. And if people understood that, they wouldn't be so quick to ban Huckleberry Finn.
Amen.
Which that's the book I think of first when I think of unreliable narrators.
Yeah.
So then she asked this bit at the end. When approaching an unknown book or ostensibly a new book, what should be our assumptions about a narrator? So that gets into, you know, the act of reading, the art of reading. You know, if we've become aware that not every narrator is trustworthy, it's never occurred to me not to trust somebody, then what does that mean about how I start reading a book in terms of my interaction with a narrator? And I guess the question is, well, it alludes to what you just said. What are the questions that we should be asking as we begin to get to know and experience the perspectives of a narrator in a book? Karen, when you're thinking about teaching in particular, how do you think about that question?
Well, if I'm teaching something, then I go in knowing way more than...
No, that's true.
So just as a reader, I mean, I think we should assume nothing and go in with our eyes open. And so, you know, I tend more towards formalist criticism. So I'm really just like wanting to look mainly at the text and how the text answers those questions. But we also measure it against the world. Like if we ask ourselves, is this guy serious? Is this what, you know, I mean, ask those kinds of questions. If we see something is off, then we say, okay, is it off because this is a different world that I don't understand? Or is it off because there's something else going on here? In the same way, I mean, wishes were horses. I wish people would approach Twitter this way. But, I mean,
that was a fantastic sentence.
I mean, if someone like stop and ask yourself if a tweet is being ironic or straight, just ask yourself. If it seems over the top, then like just say, oh, maybe they're being sarcastic here. I mean, a simple question, but people don't often ask that.
Right. Yeah, I think one question to ask when you're going in is, is it possible? So let's say you pick up a book and you're like, oh, I found this book called Catcher in the Rye and this looks interesting, right? And then you start to read it and you, like a couple pages in, you're like, I actually just hate this guy, right? Mm-hmm. Like sometimes that's what happens. I think Holden's wonderful. But a lot of times people will pick up that book, get a couple pages in and cast it aside, this degenerate story and whatever, right? But what if you said, is this how I'm supposed to feel about this character? What if that's on purpose, right? Now you're behind the eyes of an unreliable narrator, and then you can make proper judgments about the world of that novel instead of just assuming that the moral world of the novel is exactly what is at face value. Mm-hmm. And so if you're wanting to love Catcher in the Rye, you have to know that this is an unreliable narrator. Right. So that, I think one of those questions is it possible that this kind of reaction that I'm having to this protagonist when I'm behind his eyes is something I'm supposed to have? And then what if I just kind of lean in to that and follow that where it goes?
Exactly.
I love the distinction that you kind of made there between making assumptions and making judgments.
Mm. Yeah. They're two different things.
Yeah. Okay. Next question. This is from Hope. She asks, how do you approach teaching a novel such as this one where knowledge of the social context is so related to understanding the book? How do you help students recognize the humor or satire? And do you have any strategies for helping younger, say teen readers, to lay aside their modern assumptions and accept the world of the author? Karen, I'll start with you on this one as a professor, you're dealing with this one, you know, every day in your classrooms. And then Heidi, I'll let you just jump in after that.
Well, I can't think of a class where I don't teach works chronologically, whatever the period is, whatever the genre is. that's a big part. Teaching sort of thing in context, even if it's just like a century or two centuries that I'm covering or whatever, because so much of literature is, as I've already talked about, like Austen's influence of Samuel Richardson, who was the father of the English novel, and she's drawing upon. So teaching a work in historical context and chronology is helpful. And I spend a lot of time providing background and talking about the kinds of things that we've been talking about here to fill students in, which is not, you know, which people might think, oh, that's, you know, I can't just pick up a novel and read it. Well, yeah, you can, but you can also, you know, I mean, who doesn't watch a who doesn't watch Stranger Things without talking to other people about it and having a Facebook thread about it? I mean, even when we consume popular culture, we usually do it as kind of part of a community and we talk about it. And so even picking up classic works of literature, there are all kinds of resources that we can draw on to increase our understanding and our appreciation. So I think we have to do that.
There's a follow-up question here, which Lisa says, what's the most important thing, the most important thing to stress in teaching Austen, aside from historical and social context, which is tough on its own, I think is what she was, yeah, which is tough on its own. Karen, I'll let you answer that, and then I want to turn to Heidi for the next question. I do want to move a little bit faster on a couple of these questions here, because there's a few I want to get to. So what do you think about that? Most important thing to stress in teaching Austen?
It's irony, that there's satire there. I mean, I can't even count the people who've told me that they did not know that. And then when they went back and read it, understanding that there's irony there, it changes everything.
Agreed. Okay. Aaron asks, Heidi, I'm going to give this one to you. This book is often described as being a comedy of manners, but I also hear many say that it's a sort of handbook for how to behave properly. I used to find those ideas to be irreconcilable, but I think your discussions on the podcast have helped me see it as a bit more nuanced combination of both. Having said that, how do you feel that this book edifies a modern audience? Assuming the modern reader can understand the expectations at that time, what are the takeaways for our time? You mentioned a few modern terms that apply to the story, the drunk dial and maybe ghosting, for example. There was definitely some ghosting going on. So what virtues transcend the satirical aspects of these characters' manners and can be applied today?
Sure. It is a great question. And she's right. Those things can be reconciled. There is a lot of satire and irony. But if you look at the fate of the main characters, you're going to find the moral virtues that Austen is upholding and pointing at, right? So these young women that have remained virtuous throughout the whole story, they haven't fallen into the foolishness or the evils of what the satire is pointing at. Or if they have to a certain extent, then they become redeemed. They repent and are redeemed, and then they are rewarded. So that's kind of how you can tell in these comedy of manners in some of these novels what kind of virtues are being upholded is the fate of the main characters. So I think in terms of what virtues transcend the satirical aspects of these characters' manners, which, by the way, is a beautifully constructed sentence, like a beautifully crafted question. Again, look at that. Look at these main characters that are Colonel Brandon, Edward, and then Marianne and Eleanor. You look at how they live and how they are rewarded at the end, and what those are the virtues that you're going to be looking for. And we've talked about those over the podcast.
Karen, do you want to have 30 seconds to add to that?
I think also that just all the film adaptations that are updated versions of the stories are really great ways to, like Clueless, same story, modern times, or, you know, I think that's why Austen is so often adapted and updated in film, because what she says still so applies to today.
Okay, next question. This is from Elizabeth. Is Lucy Steele the actual worst female Austen villain? I definitely think she is and would love to hear the host's thoughts on this one. Christy says, I don't know, Mary Crawford is pretty bad, but way funnier, so there's that. Karen, what do you think? Is Lucy Steele the actual worst female Austen villain?
She probably is, I think. I mean, she's the one freshest on my mind, so I don't want to
deserve
the right to change my mind. But yeah, she's pretty bad.
She's so bad. I really like the turn that this thread takes into Harry Potter. It's like my favorite thing.
Yeah, I was just browsing over that.
Then we get to talking about how Umbridge is worse than Voldemort, which is agreed, right? So I'm on the side of Mary Crawford. I think Mary Crawford is worse than Lucy Steele, but because she is degenerate in like she her virtue is lost as well. So I think
Mary Crawford from Mansfield Park, right?
Yes. But I think Lucy Steele is the most like the most Umbridge-ish. Mm. Like just the most like
annoying.
And low class, which is also really stressed in this book.
Wasn't Mary Crawford played in the movie by the same character who played the main character in Howard's End? What is her name?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't seen Howard's End.
Oh. Well, you should watch that. Okay. I have no idea why I felt like I needed to say that. Okay.
Always bring in the movie.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Why would Eleanor and her mother care his question?
Well, I was gonna come back to that one. I guess now we can do that. Okay, so Kara asks, why would Eleanor and her mother consider it unseemly to simply ask Marianne if she was engaged? It's hard for me to imagine not just having the conversation with a sister who is a best friend or a daughter that I'm extremely close to. Heidi, what do you think?
Actually, I don't know the answer to that.
Karen, what do you think?
This came up in my book club, my in-person book club too.
Okay.
So I think it's a couple things. One thing is it's such a bad thing for Marianne to do. Like, it's just so sort of unspeakable to think that she would be carrying on without actually being engaged, that it's a hard thing to bring up. It's sensitive because it would be acute. You know, I mean, think of something just, well, I guess today's like it would be hard to, even if you're close sisters, to say, hey, are you sleeping with your boyfriend? I mean, it would be almost like on that level, you just wouldn't want to, it would be accusatory to even ask, I think. And they don't want to even think that she would be doing these things without being engaged. Doing these things, just the social impropriety of gallivanting around with him. That's how serious it was.
Okay. Julia asks, Heidi, I'll turn to you on this one. What's the purpose role of Margaret Dashwood's character? She doesn't seem to serve any plot function, but Austin is too masterful to write in characters who don't matter, right? Would there be some social propriety problem with Mrs. Dashwood remaining at the cottage alone when Marianne and Eleanor go to London? And then I'm guessing this is Fern, says she puzzled about that too for a while and then decided Austin needed someone who could put certain classified information into Mrs. Jennings' hands in a way that doesn't put us readers on our guard about other adult characters. So, Heidi, what's your take on this? The purpose of Margaret Dashwood's character, and then Karen, you jump in on that as well if you'd like to.
Yeah, I have always read it as a necessary to the plot, specifically to their mother being left alone when they went to London, because it would be kind of unkind to leave her without somebody there. So I have thought of her as kind of a crutch character. Like, certain things, she doesn't have much of a personality or a big role, but she fills in some of those other things. Maybe there's more to it than that though, Karen.
Well, there's that funny part where she reveals Eleanor's love, this character, whatever. And that's a little bit of a humor. But I almost think that it's, this may be overreading it. I would never be guilty of such a thing. No. But again, what Austin is constantly doing is talking about how virtue is the moderation between two extremes. And I think having a third sister is actually, even though it's not drawn out, there's a moderating presence there. It's not just two sisters. And I always think of Margaret as just kind of that little reminder of a more Trinitarian view. I don't know, but evening one another out.
I was thinking about her as almost being, so as much as Eleanor and Marianne change in great significant ways, and then in other ways they kind of stay the same, Margaret is kind of in some ways like a blank slate who still has yet to grow up. And there's almost this question of who is she going to grow up to be more like? I mean, as you said, is she going to be sort of the middle ground between them as she grows up, or is she going to lean one way or the other? And so there's this sort of stasis of with where she's got to make these choices. We know she's going to have to make these choices in the future. So whereas Eleanor and Marianne are off in their families, what choices is Margaret going to make that either imitate or separate? That either bring her closer to her sisters who are now very close, or who remain very close after getting married, or separate her from them. So I don't know that Austin was doing that on purpose, but that's what strikes me, is that this character is going to have to make choices that are going to determine who she's most like and who she's most not like, or, you know. Anyway.
And maybe it's just a point of realism. I mean, these families didn't have just two children unless, you know, unless there were some health or illness issues. And so, I mean, just families had many, many children, generally speaking, and that makes this family more realistic. And they're all girls. There is no male figure there. It just, after the father dies, so.
Did Austin have two sisters herself?
She had one sister, but... eight children, I think. So only two were girls.
Okay.
I got the number right, but many, many brothers.
Okay. All right. Jesse asks, does Jane Austen hate extroverts? We're always her worst characters and only grow better by becoming less extroverted. Heidi, I will let you ask that.
I love this question. So, I mean, some of that's going to be just kind of the British ethos, right? Like this, especially that time period, like, you know, women are supposed to be restrained and quiet and children should be seen and not heard. And everything is so proper. And there's these rules around interactions, who you can talk to and how long you can talk and what you do for fun and who you can be with. And so that's kind of some of the delight of Austen. That's why modern readers, I think, are initially drawn to Austen, is this idea that, like, wow, this hierarchical, like, society in which everything is kind of set out. And but she's right. A lot of the women who talk too much, the women who are, you know, longing for attention from men and who dominate a conversation, they are the foolish ones that receive some kind of comeuppance in the story. So, and I think that has more to do with the comedy of manners idea than it has to do with any kind of innate personality kind of thing that Austen was reacting against. But I think it's a fair question.
Well, I love the way Jesse put it. She said, I love Austen, but she's a cautionary tale for this ENFP.
Yep.
Karen, what do you think about this? Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think those categories are just, they didn't exist in Austen's time. And so she would be more about, you know, gossiping and impulsiveness versus reflectiveness and circumspection. And so, I mean, I can see how people would read them today as introvert and extrovert, but I don't really think that's what she was dealing with in her mind.
Right.
Okay, here's a very specific question that is the kind of question that I love. Sarah asks, what is the significance of Edward using scissors in the scene where he reveals he is no longer engaged to Lucy? She then offers some possible options, but I want to hear what you guys have to say. Heidi, do you have any thoughts on this?
So I read that question this morning, and this the first thought I thought this exact thought. David is going to make sure we get to that question. Because you...
So then you've been thinking about it all day in anticipation, and you have a great answer.
I like that about you and how you read. You notice these things. I don't notice those things all the time. I didn't even notice that in the scene. So I went back and read it, and sure, I think it could be the cutting off of the relationship with Lucy, kind of that symbolic picture of it. And so, yeah, that is just one of those details that's really kind of brilliant, but not every reader catches it. So I really appreciate the readers who do.
Now, you need to remind me, he uses scissors in which, what does he do with them in this scene?
He just picks them up.
He just picks them up. Oh, okay. Yeah, well, to me, they just remind...
He cuts her hair.
Yeah.
No, because we have two locks of hair, right? In the novel. And there's a long tradition, you know, there is, and whether they were taken... Scissors would be used to... That's a long-standing trope in literature, is cutting off the lock of hair, which is hair is a symbol of fertility. And I mean, Alexander Pope wrote a whole satirical epic poem called The Rape of the Lock, which is about a lover cutting off a piece of a lock of hair and sending the heroine into fits. And so I think those scissors are just reminders. They would have always been lying around, but they're also reminders of the locks of hair that have shown up in the story and all that those symbolize. And yeah, I think it's a brilliant detail.
Brandon says, he commented that he thinks it was Jane letting women know that the men are always going to ruin your sewing scissors, even your dream man. It's inevitable. But I think I immediately connected that with the moment with Lucy's, the end of Lucy's hilarious letter, uh-huh. where she's like, don't worry, you can keep the lock of hair.
Great.
And because he could have, you know, the scissors are on the scissors, like there's so much potential in a pair of scissors, like so much potential for action. He could cut the letter in half. You know, he could cut hair. I mean, there's so much you could stab someone with scissors in theory. Uh-huh. So one thing that I was thinking about a lot, I've been reading Cormac McCarthy. I've been reading No Country for Old Men. And one of the things that Cormac McCarthy is obsessed with, which I think is why the Coen brothers made a good movie out of his stuff, is he's obsessed with the work that people do. Like the things they do with their hands, like the way you go from one thing to the next, all the steps that it takes to do things. And I was thinking about how Austin doesn't spend a lot of time in this is the work that people are doing. This is how they're doing them. So I was struck by the fact that like she doesn't spend a lot of time talking about the things that people have in their hands, unless it's like a book or the keys of a piano. But then that's usually happening kind of off the edge of the scene. So it really was striking to me that here she puts this tool in this man's hand, because even when when it talks about the lock of hair or whatever, it doesn't talk about the actual cutting of the lock of hair. Right. We don't get that scene. And so I think it's just because I've been reading McCarthy and kind of been noticing how much time he spends obsessing over the way, the steps that people take to do what they're doing, that I was noticing that doesn't happen as much in this. And so it makes that moment or that much more striking in this book. That was kind of like, just, I don't have a lot to say about that, except that, you know, there's a difference there. And so it does make that scene striking because of the way the rest of the book operates. Mm-hmm. Looking for this next question. We'll wrap it up here in a second. Karen, I want to touch on this before we go, because you brought this up at the very beginning. There's two questions I want to touch on before we go. Karen, you mentioned this question. Gabrielle asks Sense and Sensibility and Heart of Darkness in the first episode. And she says, can we hear a bit more about the quote, girly girl novel idea that you brought up and how Austin might or might not bridge that gap in this particular novel?
Well, that's a good question. I think all of Austin bridges that gap. And that's something a lot of male readers not familiar with her don't know. They think she's just, these are love stories, and they're not. So in this novel, again, I would go back to the philosophy that was the philosophical questions about sense and sensibility and whether or not we know things primarily through our sense, the intellect, or through our bodily sensation, sensibility. That was a really important intellectual philosophical conversation taking place. And Austin is like right there in the middle of it, embodying it through these characters. So I think just her knowledge of the philosophical questions of the day, is bridges that gap. This isn't just about romance. Mm.
Okay, so of course my browser just reloaded, so I just lost the thread. So 1 second. How did you want, while I'm looking for this thread again, do you want to respond to that?
No, I think that was beautifully said. I don't have anything else to say about that.
I don't believe that, but... Mm. Okay, so... Well, I know what the question was. I wanted to give the exact wording. But the questioner said that we mentioned, this was from Jill. We mentioned at a couple of different times, I think maybe in the first episode, the sort of how it feels a bit like a fairy tale sort of. It's got the whole Marianne's kind of a damsel in distress situation and all that sort of thing. And she wanted to know, Okay, here, I found it. My thing, okay. My computer reloaded. Okay, so she says, in the first episode, I think you all address the fairy tale feel of the book. There's the Marianne as the damsel in distress and some things like that. She said, I'd love to hear this idea revisited now that we've got the whole story. So that's not a question, but Heidi, do you have thoughts on this? I thought you might have some thoughts on the fairy tale feel of this book. Do you feel that as it gets to the end of the book, that sense sort of is a thread throughout the whole book, or were we kind of just picking on something that stood out to us early on?
Oh no, it's there. Whether or not Austin intended to create kind of a series of Cinderella stories, she does. Like we have the princess who's destined to be united to a prince and to inherit the kingdom, right? And who goes through a series of trials and is misunderstood, often by older women, which is a kind of a big deal in fairy tales. There's the stepmother, or the wicked queen, or whatever. That's in all every Austen novel, whether it's a wicked stepsister or stepmother kind of figure. And is then separated from her love. And then the man has to come and find her, rescue her, and be worthy of her and win her. But along the way, both of them, the hero and the princess, have to be, you know, purified along the way and slay some monsters, whether internally or externally. And that is a fairy tale story. And that is a Jane Austen novel. That's the pattern of a Jane Austen novel, just set in Regency England. So yes, absolutely. These are retellings of classic Western fairy tales, which I would absolutely argue are retellings of the gospel story.
So even if she didn't, you're not saying she necessarily meant to do that per se.
I have no idea, but you know,
many of them were not even published until after she wrote this.
Well, exactly. I mean, I'm as you know, and I'm writing about this for Forma, I'm not that sold on author intent being the interpretive tool of a story anyway. So I think sometimes just to tell a good story means you're telling a fairy tale story. And I think whether she meant to or not, those elements are there.
Karen, have you ever thought about this before?
No, I'm thinking now. And so I'm resisting, but listening. And so I guess that the only...
Resist out loud.
Yeah, resist out loud.
I would say, I think I want to say, because I'm definitely resistant to the idea of Austen as fairy tales, but I'm hearing. So I just want to say then that it's the fairy tales and Austen stories and all good stories tell almost essentially the same story. So mm-hmm. It's not,
I
so
agree.
Fairy tales also are just the true.
A retelling.
Yes, yes, yes. Mm. Yes. Mm.
Is this an apple and orange thing or chicken and egg thing? Or?
Well, I think it is a semantic thing. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Like it just comes down to what are the elements of a great story.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, in Western culture, a lot of times we're gonna go back to myths and fairy tales, but they are not the primeval story. That's where somebody like Martha Pryor, I think, gets it wrong. Like they are not the story. The story is the gospel story. The world created good, the world fallen, the dragon and then Christ redeeming us and restoring the land. Like that is the story. And every good story kind of tells that story in some way and from some mm-hmm. angle.
Right.
Okay, let's go to final thoughts here. This is your last chance to say something about, well, not your last chance ever, but your last chance to say it about, Karen's got lots of chances. But Heidi, what are your final thoughts on Sense and Sensibility, on this conversation? Any threads you want to bring together? Anything that's loose that's bothering you, that's causing you anxiety that you want to bring together?
No, I'm glad you ended on the fairy tale question, because if that wasn't brought up, that was when I wanted to say that these are the reason we resonate with. There's lots of reasons moderns resonate with Jane Austen. She remains enduringly popular over the centuries, and some people want to know why that is. And I think there are some reasons inherent in our culture of modernity that doesn't have those kind of anchoring social mores that she explores, whether satirically or as virtuous. And so I think there's some of that, but some of it is just the fact that she tells a great story, the story of somebody
the story of an ordinary life kind of going through these deep, dark valleys of the soul and this rise to happiness and resolution that look so different in the lives that the three of us lead, that, you know, we're not going off in these grand adventures. We're not going into the heart of darkness, right? But we live a life similar to this when we just keep going and try to do the next good thing. And sometimes we suffer and sometimes we see reward for that. But it's always kind of the choice before us. And I think that's one of the reasons why Austin endures is that exploration of ordinary life, but also greatness of soul. So I just think we should keep reading Austin.
Karen?
Wow, that's hard to follow. Thanks. I guess I'll just say that I think the greatest, and again, this pushes back against the cultural, the popular conceptions of Austin, and just encourage people as they reread Sense and Sensibility or any of other Austin's novels to think about how she so challenges in a prophetic way, the radical autonomy that is pervasive today. So for Austin, happiness and virtue are all deeply tied to family and community rather than self. And I just think that is such good medicine for us today that that's something to really look for. There's so many good things in Austin, but that's one of the things that we really need today and one of the best gifts she can give us today.
Well, again, thank you to you both for being on the podcast for this conversation. We're done with another book here on Close Reads. Thanks to everyone who sent in questions and engaged in conversation on social media and politely fought with one another. That's the best part when people fight politely with each other about the books. I guess that's just called a dialogue. This has been a lot of fun. Karen, again, thanks for making the time for us. I know you're busy and you're working on some other projects and things like that, including the new book that just came out. So thank you so much for taking the time to join us on the podcast.
Well, thanks for letting me be part.
Before we let you go though, how is that book going? I mean, how did you release that book last week, right? The new one?
Yes. I mean, it's a textbook. I never really expected it to get this attention. Well, I say that, but you know, you always hope, and we've got some pretty neat names in it, and it's going well. Cultural engagement, a crash course in contemporary issues. I much prefer Austin and literature, but you know, this is another part of my life is engaging culture. So
exactly, yeah.
And we have an excellent. The best section is the section on the arts. So get it just for that.
But so, where should people get it? I think we said last week, Eighth Day or Hearts and Minds or somewhere like that, as opposed to Amazon. I think we're.
Who am I to fight Amazon? People, you can get it. just get it anywhere. But if you want to support the independent booksellers, which you know is a good thing to do, then those are the two that I recommend. But you can get it anywhere.
And of course, next week. Well, actually, no, not next week. In like 3 days, you're going to be joining us in Louisville for our conference, and Eighth Day Books is going to be there. So if you're going to be at the conference, maybe if you're polite and nice, you can buy a book from Eighth Day Books and Karen might even put her signature in the front cover. I didn't ask her that. So you have to be really polite, maybe bring her a gift or something. But you know,
we shall see.
Exactly. it's a cliffhanger, right? Well, again, thanks so much for joining us. Thanks to everyone who's been listening. And don't forget that next week we are going to start on the Odyssey. We're going to use Emily Wilson's translation. You can read whichever one you like, but we're going to use that new translation as our guide. And we're going to discuss books 1 and 2. And I'm sure we'll touch on the introduction a little bit, although we won't be talking about it as an individual text per se. So again, books 1 and 2 for next week. With that, for Heidi White, for Karen Swallow Pryor, and for all of us here at the Close Reads Podcast Network, I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening. Happy reading, and we'll talk to you next week.